Welcome to the Spoken Word Wales web podcast. I'm Martin Lowcock, I'm the host. I run the website Spoken Word Wales, which is at spokenwordwales.weebly.com, and also on Twitter as Spoken Word Wales, and on Facebook as Spoken Word Wales. The website aims to cover poetry and related events in Wales, as the name suggests. And this podcast is a monthly podcast featuring interviews with writers and performers in the area. And for this very first episode, I'm joined by Carly Holmes, who's just published her first novel, The Scrapbook, published by Parthian Books. And what follows is a long discussion about the book and other things. For reasons of space, I've had to edit down some of the tangents we got onto, but I hope that what's left where it makes sense. You'll hear a bit of background noise. We were recording in an office with other offices, doors opening and closing, but I hope that the sound quality is enough for you to fully appreciate what Carly has to say about her work. Right, well, welcome Carly Holmes to the Spoken Word Wales website, podcast. Right, so yeah, so I should be Dr. Carly Holmes now.
Well, yeah, or just call me Doc.
I was trying to work some elaborate pun around sort of Doctor and Holmes and Watson. And sort of,
You've had that.
People always think they're original, don't they? Okay, so you've just... We got your PhD from Trinity St David.
Yeah, literally had my Viva up last month, so I've been awarded it with minor amendments, so should get the certificate through very, very soon.
Are you going to go to the ceremony to have
I will do, yes, I'll do that for my parents. that'll be next summer, but it's a wonderful thought, I think that is. That it's done, I have it, and particularly that the Viva is by me, and I'll never have to do one of those again, because that was kind of scary.
Well, I suppose it's supposed to be.
Yeah. They work hard to make it very scary.
Yeah, I suppose so. But that was the end of your creative writing courses and so on at the university.
That was it, yeah, that was the climax of the creative writing PhD. Also, I did my master's degree here, actually, in Trinity and Carmarthen campus. Oh, 97, 98, long time ago.
Well, I thought you just carried straight on.
No, I took 10 years out and didn't write anything, actually. So I did my MA back then and wrote a collection of short stories, actually, for that. And then didn't write anything for over 10 years. Started doing kind of social work stuff, moved away, moved back. Start writing again.
Alright.
So maybe it's the area.
So that's something special about being in Wales, or is it more specific than that?
To be honest, I don't know. I mean, I was living in Carmarthen before, and now I live on the west coast of Carmarthen. I can't say it's the sea air, because it wasn't much sea air where I lived before. I don't know. I think that there were natural cycles.
Yeah.
I think. And I dipped out of a natural cycle there for a number of years, and I think the longer you go without writing, the easier it is, not right? For someone like me,
yeah.
The fear sets in, and then that becomes a ruling thing, and then writing is a scary thing. The thought of writing and maybe failing, not being able to do it, I don't know. Yeah. So it was just easier not to.
Yeah,
I wanted to think about it.
Yeah.
For years.
Because I'm keeping you busy at the moment. One of the things is running the Cellar Bards.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah, I host a monthly evening with a group of writers who meet in Cardigan in the Cellar Bar. A great group of writers. We tend to have a bit like the kind of Carmarthen's Poems and Pints and obviously the Lampeter's Writers Group in Red Heron. We have an open mic. And we tend to have guest readers that will come down, so that they'll read out their work in progress or published collection or whatever. Mm. And then we have open mic, and it's a really lovely evening. It's very lively. It's vibrant. Everyone's incredibly supportive and respectful And fun, you know, it's, that nobody takes themselves too seriously. Yeah. It helps that it's in a bar, I think.
Yeah, no.
Always helps. So, yeah, it's great, I love it. I feel very, very lucky, actually, to be part of the group. I'm very proud of them. And, yeah, and just very, very happy to be involved with them. It's just been 2 years now since... A month or two, she'd asked me to come on board and help her, and within a couple of more months after that, she had other commitments and didn't want to be involved anymore, so I took it on and actually started hosting, which is scary. Every month it's scary, but it's great fun. I feel safe with them. They're a great bunch of writers.
No, as you say, earlier this year, your first novel, The Scrapbook, was published by Parthian Press.
It was indeed.
Yeah,
it came out in May.
And it's a beautiful thing, it really is.
It's a beautiful looking thing, I have to say. I adore the cover, absolutely adore it.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
A friend of mine, obviously it was her artwork, so...
Yeah, no, I mean, it really sort of stands out. And I think it's a... I mean, I suppose every first novel is sort of a reflection of that, sort of the writer's sort of history up to then. But I mean, it really is really just distinctive in the way that you've approached both the subjects you've written about, but also about the way you've presented it. It's a very bold sort of experiment, if you like.
Great.
Yeah, no, really, I mean, it really is, and it's, you know, it's not often that you read the first five pages and you suddenly think, wow, this is actually going to be an amazing journey. I mean, it's
oh, thank you.
It's a very good book. So in terms of putting it together, sort of where did the idea come from to say, okay,
that's obviously, I'm going to imagine as a writer yourself, you know, you probably get that question a lot as well. It's, where do the ideas come from? I'm not really sure. I really don't know. I don't ever really write from real life. I tend to write from the imagination.
Mm.
As much as anybody can.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously parts of myself are always put into things, but this is a complete work of fiction. You know, there are certainly parts of me in all three of the women, some more than others. But for me, I think it's themes... You know, I have things that I am very curious about, obsessions.
Yeah.
That I like to. I will probably spend the rest of my life returning to these obsessions. You know, these are my particular things: relationships between mothers and daughters, memory. The foolishness of memory fascinates me.
Yeah.
And just how one person's truth and another person's truth are actually completely opposing, yet they are both truths of the same thing. For each of that, I'm not probably not explaining that very well, but you know, we can both experience the same thing and have different versions of it, but they're both true to us.
Yes,
and I find that fascinating. You know, how much of what makes our past is I mean, all of our past could be a lie, then, really, couldn't it? Yeah. I mean, because the way we're looking at it is. We're obviously filtering it through our memories of it, but if our memories are that faulty, or that objective, or sort of subjective, I suppose, then maybe none of it's... I don't know, I find that I find all of that absolutely fascinating. So those are issues for me. Absence, yearning, unrequited love... You know, the kind of the skewed fairy tale, prizing that above reality. You know, these are possibly things that I've always myself. I know certainly for myself, in the character of Iris, I get her.
Iris is the mother.
Yeah. Iris is the mother. Yes, she's the mother who keeps a memory scrapbook of. The lover that she once had, who was married to somebody else, and who just disappeared. He just disappeared. They had a child together. She prized him above everything. She prized him above her own daughter. And then one day he just disappears. And she keeps a memory scrapbook of him. And this scrapbook of memories is more important to her than any possibility of return. of his flesh and blood self, because I suppose in her memories of him, these perfect memories, he's never going to reject her, and he's never going to age, and he's never going to be anything other than the perfect creature.
Yeah.
And keep this perfect love alive. And I get that. I really do get that. I think that's one of my... I'm not saying... I guess I write it out so that I don't live my life like that. I hope.
Yeah.
You know, I like to be as functional as I possibly can be living my life. But I certainly have a lot of these kind of sort of obsessions, or certainly deep interests going on, which makes me drawn to reading literature like that. And I guess makes me drawn to writing it. I know a lot of my short fiction also tends to have themes of about people's internal landscapes. I think, you know, the things that go on the edges of your vision, you know, the monsters that might flicker. So that it's not out and out horror or out and out fantasy. Some of it is, but on the whole, it isn't. It's weirdness, you know, slightly weird things that are weird and off kilter and skewed about life, and reality. I like that. That interests me, because I think as human beings we're all a bit weird and off kilter and skewed a lot of the time.
Yeah, no, I think was it the idea of this scrapbook being kept? Is that something you've done, or is it just you thought what would happen if someone did keep it?
I think it's. I mean, I can barely even really remember how it started. I think it started with a memory of a woman keeping a scrapbook of memories, and I wanted to. I had these personal obsessions, these kind of themes that I wanted to explore. Mm. I had a very sort of loose idea of how I would explore them. I'm not much of a planner when it comes to writing. I thought I would probably have to plan a lot more for a novel than for a short story, that which I don't plan at all.
Mm.
I tend to just respond to an image or, you know, just a line of prose. Or, you know, I respond in that way much more sort of instinctively. But with the scrapbook, I figured that I probably would need to grudgingly maybe plan a bit of it out. But so I started writing it in the third person.
Hmm.
It was a mix of first person and third person,
yeah.
And the Iris' stories were told in the third person, which bored me stupid, I have to say. It was a very traditional way of writing,
yeah.
And I like to take risks with my short fiction.
Mm.
Some, you know, maybe structurally I like to take risks, or I like to take risks with the subject matter, or maybe just push myself, not because I want to try new devices in a kind of an arch way, but simply because I'm very interested. I love words so much, and there's very little in my world which gives me such pleasure as writing.
Mm.
You know, the place that I go to when I write it is completely a place of contentment, and I don't get that in any other area of my life. It's wonderful for me to have that and inhabit that part of my life. So I like to explore it and play with it and push myself, you know. But I was terrified of writing the novel. You know, this was a novel. I'd never written one before. I didn't know how to do it.
And,
you know, I kind of average about 2,500 words for my short fiction, and.
Mm.
I didn't have a clue. I mean, I'd read a lot of novels, but, you know, I didn't know how to write one. So I thought I'd, you know, take the nice, safe approach, and I'd just, okay, well, I'll just write it down, you know. And third person, you know, it's for me, I think it's a safe option, the third person.
Yeah.
It can obviously also be an incredibly unsafe option and a very wonderfully daring option, but I see it as less. So for me, first person I'm much more naturally drawn to. I like the first person because I imagine I like to write about people's inner worlds, and the first person means I'm behind their eyes.
I agree.
I can inhabit a young boy, you know, by as a writer, pay some time. Just by getting behind his eye, yeah. Getting into the first person.
No, I think that all the work that goes into characterisation, in a way, if you're in first person, you're already there.
Yeah, there.
I can remember someone writing a long time ago was complaining about novels, saying, "Oh, well, the trouble is they spend too long describing the colour of everyone's eyes."
And that's something you're still told to do. I mean, yeah, people. I mean, you're not given the colour of any.
The core of the story is you have the three generations of women. You have
that's right.
Iris is the mother, Fern is the daughter, and then Ivy is the grandmother.
That's right. Yeah.
And
so we have so we've got the three women, three generations, and the absent Lawrence is basically the kind of. I suppose he's the absence that all three of the women circle around. He certainly impacts on his absence impacts on all of their lives and their relationships with each other as their relationship with him was different, very different from each other's relationship to him. That's how it affects their relationships to each other as well. So, I had those three. I had the three women in my head, and I started writing. It was more Iris's story at the beginning, and like I said, it was first person and third person.
Yeah.
It's become more Fern's story
because
it's obviously the main chapters are told through Fern's voice, through her, first person, her first person looking back, reflective, the first half of each chapter. Past tense, and then continuous present. The second half of each chapter, sort of moving the story forward through to the end, and interspersed between the chapters, you've got Iris's pages of her scrapbook, which you, I assume, don't know what they are until you get to the end when you find the scrapbook and then realise that they're each of these essentially these very poetic monologues or. Fragments of prose all form one whole, one complete whole. We've also got Ivy, the grandmother's letters and spells, which actually at one point did form one complete, similar to her letters, you know, that they were one complete section.
Yes.
But then I broke them down and sort of dispersed them through the text to kind of. I think it was a bit too dense with very separate parts of the narrative, which actually didn't interlink in any way.
Well, of course, I suppose that's one of the nice things about it. I mean, is that you know, if you call it the scrapbook, and you've got these different elements in it, you've got sort of, as you say, bits of different people's narrative, and you've got the letters, and you've got the spells, and you've got bits of quotes and so on. But it's it is a scrapbook. It is not just about it, you know. And certainly, you know, that it's that gives you the license really to sort of depart from a conventional sort of A to B narrative structure, and instead you've got this very complicated thing going on with different times. Different people's stories at different times and so on, that you've actually got and of course, you know, the beauty of sort of Fern discovering is that, you know, we're discovering alongside her what, you know, sort of as she discovers the background, that's actually, you know, we're doing it alongside it, so I mean, in a way that's it's a good way into the history is to go along with her.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much. I mean, obviously, there has to be that. As the writer of it, you know, I had to decide on the structure, and, you know, I think once you've played around with different ones, and I actually wrote it in the second person, Fern, at first.
Yeah.
The entire novel I wrote in second person.
Mm.
For the backward, reflective parts of each chapter. It was too dense. It was too dense. Yeah. I when I got to the end, I rewrote the whole thing in first person. So, and obviously, Fern, you know, as much as just making discoveries about things within, you know, within the text, or things about her father, things about her mother, things about her grandmother, she also discovers things about herself, because she's as dishonest with herself as she is with anybody else. You know, she's, I mean, that's the I think in chapter one, you know, she talks about memory and warns the reader. I think, you know, she says memory's a trickster like that, you know. This is tells an anecdote and then says, but how do I know it happened?
Yeah.
Because memory's a trickster like that. We lie to ourselves as much as we lie to anything else.
Well, certainly, I think that that's, you know, yeah, it's particularly got, you know, you get this with childhood memories where, you know, it's quite common for people to discover, you know, the internet web these days, you can actually establish categorically that something didn't happen.
Yeah.
That you have a perfect memory of. And it is bizarre that it's borrowed, isn't it? And you just think, oh, well, no, that can't have been that person because they weren't there then. Well, yeah, but you. It's an amazing, really powerful thing, and I think because you're sort of staying with the characters, you're not forcing sort of objective reality to say, okay, what is the truth here? Mm. You can stay within the person's truth, and I think so. Certainly, what sort of really came through for me, sort of all the way through, was that sort of it feels very much like it's based in a place, that it's set on an island, and it, you know, that feeling of living on an island is runs all the way through it.
Great, that's good to know, because I'm not good at writing about. I don't tend to write realistic stuff, and I don't ever really centre or locate anything that I write anywhere particular. Yeah. I mean, obviously, the island that this is set on is a fictionalised version of Jersey. You know, I've said that. I also emphasised the fictionalised. That's why I didn't call it Jersey.
Yeah.
In all my short fiction, they tend to be set. You know, it might be set in a house or a room. I think that side of my writing I possibly neglect, and I was the thing about writing something novel length was I figured it had to be set somewhere. Couldn't just be set in a handful of rooms or a car or on the side of a road. I needed to locate it somewhere so that I grounded the reader from early on, so at least they had some location which was familiar, and then I could take them away from that and possibly take them to places which were quite maybe possibly fantastical. Or certainly kind of borderline magical. Nowhere near, I have to say, as fantastical and magical as I would have liked to have gone with it. I really would have liked to have gone a lot further with that. But...
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, yeah, I suppose there's that.
I wanted to flirt with the kind of fantasy more than I did.
I understand, yeah, that I suppose that's the thing, is that it's never clear at the end about how supernatural anything is. You can choose to read it as supernatural, or you can choose to read it as a metaphor for the way that people are behaving. It was only literally got to the end, read the back flap, and said, oh, you grew up in Jersey. Until then, so without any other information, I had just assumed that these were fictional islands off the Welsh coast, and we just, you know, so,
okay, yeah.
that's fine. I think
we always apply our own what's familiar to us, don't we? So unless we're told otherwise, we will assume that it's
But as you say, in a way, it doesn't matter very much what the specifics are.
No.
But I suppose one thing that I was going to ask was about about living on an island. Do you think that there's something special about sort of that experience? Or
you have definite boundaries with an island, don't you? Particularly, obviously we and Britain live on an island, but I mean, I wasn't raised on Jersey. I was born in Jersey. We moved to England when I was young, so I returned to Jersey a lot, and my family are there. So I have beautiful memories of Jersey, and I think it certainly has informed a lot of my childhood, a lot of my thinking. For this novel, which was about the boundaries people impose on themselves. I think an island was you know, a very good location because there are natural boundaries that nature's imposed. You know, there's
cliff
and the sea, and both women, both Iris and Fern. Mm. I mean, for Fern, it's a prison until she returns, and then because it's safe, she wants the boundary. She wants the boundary world, which Iris never left.
Yeah.
So I thought that it worked quite well as a kind of a frame for their. Yeah.
I think that I think that that's you know, when you are on an island, your options are so limited, aren't they?
Mm.
And I still get this, you know, whenever I see a sort of a ship sailing off over the horizon, you know, even if you're watching the ferry going to Ireland, and there, I don't know, there's always that. I get that sort of pang. You think, oh, I wish I was on that.
Really?
And it's that, I haven't lived long on islands, but there's just something about the idea of being somewhere else, you know, and not being here, that there's something really appealing. I get the same for train stations. You think, oh, yeah, I want to get on the train. And it's, there's just that, I don't know, whether that sort of, that feeling that, you know, well, here, well, I suppose you like to have the choice, don't you? That's the thing.
I think the world's made up of people who have your kind of philosophy, actually, who have that pang for the adventure and the escape, and people who are probably more like me, who are actually naturally quite timid and really don't want to have to go anywhere else. Just want to be home and have the. I'm very insecure, I think, as a person. So I like to be very anchored in. You know, I love my home. Sure. I love to know where I am. I have probably a lot less natural curiosity about the world around me, possibly because I live a lot of my life inside my own head. I don't know. So therefore, that's absolutely. The imagination is just has no limits, does it? It's completely boundless. So. I guess I'm possibly more internally focused there.
I wouldn't overemphasize the difference. To me, I would say that I have chosen for myself a quite a cozy life, in fact. But it's just that feeling, just recognizing that there was that other life, that path less travelled, or whatever, you know, to say, well, actually, you know, there is that sort of exciting
what
thing.
What might have been.
Exactly. They, oh, we know. And of course, as soon as you start thinking about your life and thinking about the coincidences in it and so on, you think, well, no, that's crazy. You know, if I hadn't made that decision, if I hadn't gone to that university or got that grade or whatever, then you know, who knows who I'd be with and where I'd be. You know, it is a sort of a scary thing, which I think come back, you know, with most of the characters in the novel, actually, that they're convinced that they've met their one true love, and if they can't have them, then they'll have nobody, and that's it. And I think there's this feeling of fate,
and actively reaching and actively choosing absence, isn't it? I mean, really, all of them. Particularly so with Iris and. And Fern, I think probably the one that has the most functional, if you can call any relationship of any of us functional, but the most functional relationship of the lot would be the grandmother Ivy, because you know, she steals the love of her life from her sister, you know, just before the wedding, and then runs away with him and marries him and has a daughter with him and loves him until the day he dies and loves and adores him and he loves and adores her, but. She then loses, well, obviously she loses family because she loses her sister and the respect and love of her parents and sets herself up as an exile. But she also exiles herself from her home, her island.
Yeah.
So for her, her yearning is all about the absent home.
Yeah.
So the island for her represents something very different from what it represents to both Iris and Fern. But there's very much yearning is pretty much dictates her life, but yearning for...
Yeah.
Yearning for the island more than the yearning for the man, and that almost a kind of certainly a warped version of that gets passed down to Iris, who then falls in love with Lawrence, possibly falls in love with him because she can't have him, falls in love with him exactly because he's married to another woman and she can be to him what the island was to her mother. She can be that one person who is able to act out this perfect love. They will never experience, I mean, I think it's the one bit where she says, you know, I will never experience, you know, glowering at each other over the breakfast table, you know, I'll never have to wash, you know, wash your underpants in the sink. We will, this, while you just dip in and out of my life when you choose, and you know, we have this passion which is never going to burn out because we're never going to get a chance to be cosy or domestic.
Yeah.
So she chooses that, and maybe even denies him the opportunity to have the alternative, you know, an alternative life with her. Maybe he would have left his wife for her. Maybe they could have actually had a relationship, a proper relationship, and she would never have allowed that.
No. I think that it's.
Maybe she would have.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I suppose you're sort of. If you sort of, I suppose I think if you believe in love at first sight, and you know, sort of, you know, the one true love, then it's almost like a free pass. You say, well, you know, all of my behaviour is going to be is going to be allowable because it's for love, and that therefore you don't have to worry about, you know, who
and everything who else gets mangled. No. Since medieval times and before, is basically giving us that as the template, haven't they?
Yeah.
This love at first sight. You know, this all-consuming love that we experience, and which then enables us to behave as badly as we'd like because we're doing it for love, which is, you know, and yeah, I think in a way that's exactly what Iris is doing, and of course she prizes him essentially, or certainly prizes thoughts of him and his absent self over her flesh and blood relationships with her mother and particularly with her daughter Fern.
Mm.
So Fern is then raised with this memory of an absent father who she blames for her mother's breakdown, emotional and mental breakdowns, and also for her mother's not loving her as much as she loves him.
Mm.
And then of course then she goes and does exactly the same thing herself. She falls in love with a man who literally, and I think with when she meets Rick, who is obviously the love of her life, who's married to somebody else, and who wants to leave his wife for her, and who she has never allowed him to ever even verbalise that, because she wants to keep him and herself in that place. Mm. When she towards the end of it, when she meets him, I actually wanted to make that kind of almost magic realist, where you know, he literally, they meet in a cafe, he scratches her accidentally, and he has blood. He has paint.
Mm.
He has blue paint under his fingernails, and that paint enters the bloodstream, and becomes infected. You know, the scab becomes infected, and she imagines her heart as being like a Fabergé egg with blue speckles in it. You know, and that he's literally entered her and invaded her bloodstream. He's become a part of her in a very physical way, and. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's the way she. I don't think he stood a chance, quite frankly, when he met her. I think that's going to be her one.
And
I hope that she was able by the end to. She certainly wanted to change.
Yeah.
To change that template.
Yeah. No. I think that's interesting. Yeah. Because you know, having gone through the history with her mother and grandmother. She can see that there are downsides to that. But
it is safe. I think isn't that a very safe way to love somebody?
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
To put them beyond.
Yeah.
You know, beyond touch and beyond.
Yeah.
Petty argument and put them, you know, and never let either of you destroy it.
Well, I think I saw a review of a documentary about the One Direction fans, and they were saying, well, actually, part of the power of that sort of One Direction adoration is that they are unreachable. that if they turned up and had tea with you, then that would destroy it. That part of
Absolutely. The part,
you know, that complete devotion to someone who's unreachable
is
in a way it's a cop out because you're saying
complete cop out. Empty vessel, isn't it? You're basically they can be anything you want them to be. So you're kind of denying them a voice. And actually, Lawrence, I think in the novel he's deliberately denied a voice because he never speaks.
Mm.
You know, all of the women have their own versions of him. Fern's version of him is different from Ivy's, and that's different from Iris's. And they all, he's mentioned by all of them. You know, he's a different man to each of them, but you never really know his. He's a complete cipher. You never get his version of who he is because he's denied a voice. Because it's not. It's his absence which just makes him so important.
Yeah, exactly. So they just project. No, I mean, I certainly got
it's their
that.
The,
exactly. In a way, he didn't matter. Which is a bizarre thing to say when you think about it. You know, he's saying there's all this obsession focused on that person, but you know, the passion is so strong from one side that it's actually stopping you see what the, you know, anything coming back the other way. And I think that that's, you know, sort of. The, I think that you know, you think well. Someone said to sort of whether a play is a comedy or tragedy is a question of timing and perspective.
I was
thinking about this about you know that you know if there were sort of the, if the male characters had a say, what they would say, and in a way there's a completely different story there about you know people abandoning their wife or family and you know and that you know that and what they you know what they saw and it was it's interesting that you have you've got this completely different perspective depending on you know who you're with because I think when you come back to what you're saying about sort of magic realism I think one of the things that you know what's great particularly about the way that the Fern character talks is that she obviously sort of feels like she lives in a world of meaning. That everything, you know, the world isn't just out there; it's actually responding to her life, or has a go at her. But either way, it's not a passive, you know, it's not a straightforward, you know, like a realistic view of, you know.
Yeah, she really inhabits the living world.
Because I mean, I think that's sort of that, and that's reflected in the description. So, I've picked out a few of the descriptions, which I thought really sort of, really well. I'm amazed when you said you don't like poetry, because I thought this is the sort of thing that could be a poet, but poem isn't. So like we've got this bit where she's waiting for the ferry. So just in time to hop over the barrier and settle myself onto the heather. I'm alone up here today, pressed between the sulky violet of the sky and the fidgeting grey of the sea. The approaching storm is vivid against the horizon, the distant loom of Sorrel no more than a bruise in the mist. I literally, when I read that, I put it down and said, wow.
Oh, well, thank you.
Because it's, I mean, because what's that combination, and you can see, I mean, you know, there are people like this, that, you know, it's the way she's talking there is, it's sort of a straightforward, you know, there's nothing in there that's inherently magical. But there is that emotional content all the way through, that feeling like the weather has come to get her. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's how I like to write. I mean, I love a living world around us, you know, a living, breathing world that has teeth. I actually wanted, because obviously they've got an oak tree which features throughout, you know, and I don't think there's a chapter that goes by which doesn't have the oak tree in it. Mm. I mean, literally, it's their family tree, you know, it's a keeper of their secrets. I was determined when I first started writing it to make the oak tree speak. I really wanted the oak tree to actually have a voice.
Yeah.
I couldn't pull that one off, you know. Maybe one day I'll be able to write a book about a talking tree, but not quite yet in my career. But because I love Angela Carter's, you know, I love fairy tales, you know, and you've got talking trees, and, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, I love quite atavistic, magic realism, and quite raw, a raw and a passionate world.
Yeah,
that interacts with us, you know, actively interacts with us.
Yeah.
like fairy tales.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, I think, I suppose that's the thing, is that, you know, that's, as you've written it, that you can read this as being a fairy tale type world, or you can see this as being our world, where these people, and Fern in particular, but the others as well, I mean, they've certainly got Ivy with her magic spells, that they believe that they live in the fairy tale world, or they act as if they do, and you don't have to come, you know, you can run through the novel without having to come out one way or the other about whether this is actually true. All you can say is, well, this is what people believe. Mm. And, you know, in the same way, you know, people, you say people can believe in coincidences, you know, and that clearly coincidences happen. Mm. But whether you choose to see that they have meaning is your choice.
Absolutely.
You know, and so at the moment, as I say, I think that, you know, that...
I think for Christmas and the Tooth Fairy. I mean,
well, yeah, exactly. No, exactly. You can move wholeheartedly into sort of the world of sort of the fantasy, the fairy tales, or whatever. Or you know, as you have. I mean, these are the way people actually live their lives. And there are people who are superstitious. There are people, you know, that they won't go into room 13 or whatever. Mm. And you think, well, it's odd how there are these beliefs. And you know, people touching wood, they do it all the time.
I do.
you say, well, why? Well, it's an interesting thing about, you know, about how we behave, and how, you know, how much of our behaviour is rational, how much isn't.
Mm.
And certainly, I think, yeah, sort of what you have is, there are people, you know, all over the place, there are people like Fern who are the stars of their own story, basically.
Yeah.
And that they're sometimes a bit hard to deal with, because they are sort of swanning off and doing, you know, they're responding to what they see as being the sort of important things. But later in the story we catch up with Fern when she goes over to university, and I just thought this was a really nice mixture between, again, it's that sort of depiction of what's really there, but also that sort of emotional content. The warm, heavy bundle on the bed hadn't moved. I climbed onto the mattress and wedged myself into the soft dreams of my friends. Curled between the sweet damp of their breath, limbs flickering their descent into sleep, I sighed pleasure through crimson lips, trailing grease paint across the pillows. I hadn't realised that university could be this much fun.
And there's one bit as well on that same page, I think, where she says, in a green glass pot on my desk I kept... in a green glass pot on my desk I stored my broken promises to unwritten essays. I mean, and that's...
Yeah.
For me, I wrote that for me, you know, that was my little touch of magic realism, because she literally, in my head, she does literally have a green glass pot.
Yeah, no, I...
And
I,
she stores
I,
those
I,
promises.
I, that's how I understood it.
Yeah.
Because there are people, I suppose we all do it a bit, but yes, there are people who do... Yeah, that who, because of, you know, their what they believe, that they will do things which, you know, other people might think is a bit weird. I mean, there's one thing that I remember I bought from Oxfam a while ago, which was a little bag of a worry bag, where you have these little people, and you see what you do before, you know, to help you sleep.
You tell them
your worries, put them in the bag, and then they'll look after them while you're sleeping.
Yeah.
And you think, well, that's crazy. But actually, I mean, some of you...
I think
crazy, sorry. But, you know, psychologists, you know, they say, well, no, that's actually a very powerful technique. In the same way that writing journals are a powerful technique, because there are some people who are quite happy to write a diary who wouldn't dream of having a little bag of worry. And I just thought this last bit was a lovely bit of writing, but you can hear someone's voice. So, I was 23 when I met him, Rick, 3 months away from home and my mother, 3 lonely months and still hollowed out from the still hollow from the medication I'd weaned myself off, still fighting the mornings. And I thought that's the rhythm of that. Again, I'm amazed you say you're not a poet, because just the rhythm of the thoughts there, it just really, that you can hear someone saying that or thinking that. It's a very specific, I don't know, there's this, you know, you could write a very boring sort of, as you say, sort of third person type account of that experience. But what you've done, what's nice there is,
well, that's what first person enabled me to do, was I could get right inside her head. And I mean, I'm not a poet, but I love words. I think they're just endless and unbelievably exciting, and I love putting them together, and I love the sound, you know, sort of like alliteration and structure and rhythm, you know, as well as beautiful images.
Yeah,
I do love beautiful images and poetic prose.
Yeah.
I mean, I might, you know, well concentrate, say that bit you read out, I could well concentrate on the sound, you know, the structure and the tempo of it. I think is as important in a novel as in a poem.
Well, yeah, well, I think it comes back to what you were saying about sort of whether we need to describe people, and you don't need to describe that speaker. You know, that tells you about who they are much better than telling them what colour pyjamas they're wearing.
Absolutely.
And I think that's...
Or what kind of travellers was on. You don't need to
know. No, exactly. And I think that's, you know, you can go through and describe everything, but actually, you know, something like that is so immediate. Say you can sound, it sounds, you know, very much, you know, you feel that is the voice of a real person speaking, and it's, you know, and what's nice, of course, is that that's Fern speaking, or the speaking, thinking, whatever. But the other characters sound like themselves as well. You know, sort of, they don't, you know, because I think otherwise there's always that danger, is they just think, oh, well, it's just you. Which, yeah, I'm not that's, you know, that wouldn't be terrible, but it's not the same thing. But I think what's impressive is that you've created a group of characters who are very who sound different, you know, that they are.
That's good to know. I mean, there are some writers who are wonderful writers. Who every character sounds like them.
Yeah, well, actually,
every thought that every character has.
Yeah, we were talking about this. Martin Amis earlier.
Yes.
And you know, and what
that's been levelled at him.
Very much so, because you, I mean, as you have to say, is that you know, if every single one of his working class characters has to mysteriously have this familiarity with English literature and a vocabulary which is, you know, way out of what anyone would expect, you think, well, it loses that tang of authenticity. And in a way you say these are all just fictions, and so, you know, it's not wrong as such, but it does, you know, if you're trying to make it sound like it's real, then every time you do that, you're losing a bit of that. As you can probably tell from what I've said already, I do think it is an amazing book.
Oh, thank you very much.
And I hope that it's that people are encouraged to read it, because I think it is a real treat, it's so distinctive that I think, you know, sort of, I suppose, you know, you could say, and I think the way that you've the bold use of language, I mean, seen from the examples that it's not just another sort of humdrum story of people living in a house. It's really affecting, because you really feel like you know these characters. Well, I'm talking about them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that, you know, that you buy, you really, you know, so it's really good. Great. Okay, well, so that's published by Parthian Press.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
It is literally available from all good bookshops.
And probably some dodgy ones as well.
That's brilliant. Okay, so that's that was published in the spring.
And in May, yeah.
Yeah. So and so, what are you working
on
now?
Yeah. I was awarded a Literature Wales bursary, New Writers bursary, in April, which I was incredibly lucky to receive, to work on a collection of ghost stories. Mm-hmm. So I finished the bursary period has ended now. So Parthian are going to be publishing the collection in 2016, and mm-hmm. I've probably written about half of them, and I will be spending the rest of this year creative writing wise.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine, unless I get sidetracked into other things, which may well happen. Yeah, working on the collection,
right.
Which is, I'm very excited about it. So I mean, I love a good ghost story, mm. And ghostly films, and you know. So yeah, I mean, it's going to be like a real mix though of the kind of real traditional kind of chillers and yeah. a sort of homage to the kind of the greats
mm.
of the genre, and some which will be a bit more subversive and
mm.
and I, you know, I sort of started thinking about. But I think one had to make the application to Literature Wales as well, about ghost stories and mm. hauntings and essentially what it is. It's the past encroaching on the present, mm. really, isn't it? Mm. And that, in a way, made me think of the scrapbook, which, you know,
yeah.
in a kind of quite a loose way, could be described as a ghost story.
Yeah.
Because it is about absence and haunting, the past haunting the present. So, you can really interpret a ghost, the function of a ghost in a story, you can really interpret that quite loosely. And I do intend to give myself license to do that in the collection.
Yeah, sure.
So there will be a lot of different kinds of ghosts in there, though there will be ghosts throughout. It will be a collection, a firm collection of ghost stories. And there will be some proper traditional ghost stories as well as...
Yeah.
As well as that... I'm really into nature writing. I mean, I love nature writing to read. I love Mark Cocker, his Crow Country. I think it's a beautiful book. And Roger Deakin, Wild Woods, I think it's Journey Through Trees, and others I can't think of right now. So I would love to try my hand at nature writing as well. I've got some vague things going around my head as a mix of fiction and nature writing, mm. Which I really hope that I can write. I really hope that I do. If not next year, then the year after, or the year after that. Because it's a preoccupation of mine, and I think I need to write it out, so to write it, to kind of write it out of me. So
yeah,
I hope I do. I hope I manage it.
Yeah. So that's well, I think one of the things that's, I think has changed recently about publishing in general is that there's much more willingness to try slightly weird things.
Mm.
So I think, you know, something, as you say, sort of a nature stroke fiction stroke thing book, which I think, you know, maybe 20 years ago you'd have a hard time getting anyone to think of this as a book, whereas these days I think you know the people are happy to see whatever sort of, you know, there's something for what it is. They're not necessarily saying, well, this ought to be a novel.
Yes.
This ought to be 50,000.
It's not allowed. Yes.
No, there's a freedom there about, well, yeah.
Which I think is probably one of the benefits of the world we live in, isn't it? With all the different mediums we have and technologies and all the different kinds of ways we write, you know, Twitter and Facebook, etc., etc.
Yeah.
Means that we are, you know, we've things are a lot more lax when it comes to, like you said, you know, that there aren't so many boundaries in between this writing is this or this writing is that.
Yes.
You can write poetic prose, you can write prose poems, and you can write nature writing, which also happens to be fiction, which might be a bit of memoir. I mean, it's great, actually. I think there's some very exciting things to be said about the modern day approach to writing.
Mm. Well, certainly I think that these days, but I mean, when you think of it as a, you know, it used to be that pretty much your only choice was, you know, pages on print on pages, and that was it. You know, it had to be one. Whereas these days, you know, sort of you can think, well, you know, well, is this a video project? Is it a web project? Is it a book? Is it or is it an e-book or whatever? You know, there's actually, you know, we can we can do weird things that, I mean, you know, like with Scrapbook, you could actually have it as a, you know, a web page with the objects and, you know, the stories and, you know, actually people reading the stories in the voice. And,
I mean, the actual pages of the scrapbook, I could actually make pages of a scrapbook and actually cut a piece of dark blue handkerchief and pin it to the, as it is in there. I thought about doing that, actually, you know, sort of scattering them around to try and raise the kind of... interest in it, but
I think I mean, I suppose that's the thing, is that, you know,
it'd be an art project essentially, wouldn't it?
And again, that's one of those things that unfortunately has got bad connotations with some a lot of people, that you say it's an art project, you say, well, it's just a fun thing to do, you say, oh yeah, fine, go with it. I think that's, you know, that liberation in a way, that you know, it is a real. I love books, and I hope they're going to hang around. But you can see that, you know, there are all sorts of issues about whether you know, publishing as we know it is going to, you know, is a viable thing into the future. But on the other hand, there are opportunities for us to do things in a much more We can explore things using a range of different things. I mean, I think, you know, the whole idea of, like, podcasting is that, you know, I always find when I read a sort of a typed interview with an author, I just think, well, there's hardly anything there. And it's not because they didn't go and spend an hour or two talking. It's just that, you know, print says you have to have... And I think that the opportunity to actually sort of deal with things at the length that you want to is a really powerful thing.
Yeah, and I think that an interview probably works best when it's going in through the ears as opposed to through the eyes, possibly.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think, I suppose, yeah, because we're used to hearing speech at the speed we speak, haven't we, Alan? There's always that thing. Yeah. Okay, so that's sort of what you're planning for the future. In the very near future, we've got coming up, we've got the Penvrow Festival, which you're involved with.
Yes, that's right. I'm the secretary for the Penvrow Committee, and yeah, so the festival's held in Rossagilwen, Pembrokeshire, every September. So it's on in the second week of September, which is the weekend of the 12th and 13th, I believe.
I think that's right.
Yeah, I hope so.
I'll check it. I'll add a PS if not.
Thank you.
That's
great. So that will keep me busy through the summer. We've got loads, you know, we've got sort of over the 3 days, we've got Rowan Williams, the Archbishop, or Archbishop and poet will be there, and Cowyn Jones, the bard. We've got, you know, workshops on the Saturday. We've got Owen Shear, who is a local film producer and writer, his film Castadio, about the prisoner of war camp in Ceredigion in Henland, which made a church. They made their own church.
Oh yes, yeah.
Pretty much out of whatever they could salvage. Wonderful documentary. That we're showing that there. Loads of stuff. You know, storytelling events for children. It's a lovely festival at a beautiful venue, Rossagilwen Mansion, and so that's going to keep me busy. I'm also on the Lampeter Review. I'm on the editorial board for that, so that's an amazing experience, actually. I guess I edited the last issue 9, which came out last month. It was hard work, but it was brilliant, and I was very, very proud of it.
Yeah. No, it's a lovely thing. It's not well enough known, I think.
I think it needs more prestigious, I suppose, to say that it's a
free online edited
journal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I presume it works on iPads. I haven't tried, but it works on a website.
Yeah.
But it's produced to the standard of a paper. Paper.
That's
journal.
It. And also now it's in physical form as well.
Oh, it is. So, yeah. Oh,
yes.
Know that. Oh,
yeah. Right. The last few. So there are copies available, which aren't free.
No, but it's. What's nice about it is it collects together a mixture of. So there were some sort of famous faces, if you like, and new writers, and
yes.
it seems to end up with a nice mix. I think that you know, it's sometimes we you can end up with journals which have too strong a character, and they just they can become samey. And I think it's just escaped that. So
I think it's a lovely journal. Everyone involved should be really proud of, actually.
Yeah, no, I agree. Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much for
absolute pleasure, coming in.
We'll wait developments with interest in terms of your future work.
And I do
hope people do explore the scrapbook.
Thank you. So do I. Thank you very much. Thank you. Brilliant. Can I take this one home?
Please do. Just